We've had some other concerns about health and safety in the region of late, with both fires and smoke to contend with for many of us. But all through that time and continuing into the future, we've still got COVID-19 as a primary health concern. In recent days, the United States passed another milestone, with the death toll domestically now passing 200,000 people. Jackson County has watched its counts of new cases dwindle in recent weeks. Dr. Jim Shames is the county medical director, and he joins us once again to answer questions about the disease and the work to end it. Dr. Shames, welcome back to The Exchange. Jim Shames, you there? Do we not have Jim Shames? All right, we're going to call him back. We'll get Jim Shames on the line. Let me take a look at what the numbers have been like for Jackson County of late. As of the moment, as of September 21st, 12:01 a.m., so yesterday, total cases in Jackson County, 1,057, with some caveats that there are some numbers in there that could fluctuate. Some cases get identified and then get retested and discovered, no, that wasn't COVID-19, so 1,057 with an asterisk. Total deaths in Jackson County, 4 active infectious cases, 162. Dr. Jim Shames back with us now. Welcome.
Oh, glad to be here, Jeffrey.
Give us a sense of we're just going down the numbers here. Total cases, 1,057 all time for Jackson County, but what are the trend lines looking like for you?
You know, I don't think the trends have changed, except that we continue to be concerned about all the people displaced and brought together by the fires, that's going to really raise the numbers. And we're already seeing some extended families who are forced together, bringing COVID into their family unit, and we're seeing some large multifamily outbreaks. So we're keeping a close eye on that.
All right. Remind people again, you know, how long after events, and it's been 2 weeks now, I would think that's sort of the beginning of the window to notice the changes. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's true. The incubation period averages around 5 days or so, but because so many people are asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic, it often takes a couple of weeks before you really see the effects of any particular mass gathering or mass event.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so given that this is not something that's solved right away, I mean, certainly some people who evacuated have gone back home, but we're talking potentially somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,000 families having to find new places to live, and often in closer quarters with other people. This would not bode well, I would think, for the trajectory.
No. As I said, that's definitely a concern. We're trying to gear up for it. We're trying to do some surveillance testing. For example, we're going to test everyone who's lodging at the expo as best we can today to find out whether there's sort of subterranean COVID in that particular grouping, just to help guide our, you know, guide our actions.
All right. Yeah, we didn't get a real exact count, but hundreds was what the folks at the Emergency Operations Center said in terms of population at the expo now.
Yeah.
You said testing as best we can. What are some of the issues?
Well, testing is down or had been down. So for whatever reasons, people are not thinking of it as something to do. Perhaps the anxiety is a bit lower, or people just have other things to occupy their time rather than get tested. Our ability to test is good. People taking advantage of that is down a little bit.
Do you find that that over time, I ask this sort of from my own anecdote, that I realized yesterday morning that I had gone back to the old sort of quick and sloppy style of washing hands and forgot the whole thing where you get the backs of your knuckles,
yeah,
and the spaces between, all the things that we'd learned to do with COVID, that some of these things just drop off and people start standing closer to each other without masks, et cetera.
Yeah, I've noticed that as well. And the hand washing thing is—it's true what you say. My hand washing is not quite as good as it was a month ago.
All right. So now I want to switch to talk about smoke just a bit. Smoke gave us a weekend off, and it looks like maybe today too. But how concerned are you about the long-term effects, either smoke standing by itself or smoke with COVID as part of the mix?
I'm concerned about wildfire smoke. I learned a lot about it last year, things I didn't really know before, about how inflammatory it can be and how the small particles can get in the bloodstream and inflame other organs. So I am concerned, and if you look at data from polluted cities, in terms of exposure compared to people who don't have exposure, there is a significant increase in cardiovascular disease and cancers and lung disease. So to the extent that we can mitigate it, reduce it, compensate, then the whole population is better off. In terms of its association with COVID, I would think anything that kind of weakens the immune system, weakens the lungs, and imagine somebody who's already got asthmatic side effects from the smoke and then gets COVID, I would expect their disease to be worse.
All right, so now we're looking at worst case of COVID potentially, yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned some pulmonary and cardiac effects. So that tells us that heart and lungs certainly get some of the inflammation of organs, but are there others too?
I do believe so. I think most people have focused their attention on the cardiovascular system and the pulmonary system, but I think it can increase diseases of other organs pretty much any place that the blood goes to.
All right. And again, we talked about COVID being a disease of the blood as well as the lungs. So
exactly.
Some concerns there. Dr. Jim Shames, Jackson County's medical director, joining us once again to answer our questions about COVID-19. You're welcome to get yours in here at 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760. Can't take your emails because we're having internet problems here at Southern Oregon University, and I can't seem to access that. But phone calls, great, 800-838-3760. Dr. Shames, I'm looking at the Oregon's somewhat low per capita testing rate. It looks like it's one of the lowest in the country. Unpack what you know, if you would, about the reasons and any concerns you might have about that.
I wasn't aware that our rate was so low. I knew that our positivity rate, the percentage of people positive, was lower than the nation as a whole. Some states have a much more laissez-faire testing strategy, just come on in, get tested no matter who you are or what you are. And I think Oregon has continued to focus on symptomatic people and surveillance testing. And it's, it may be that that other states just have more testing because anybody can get a test anytime. I actually think that considering the testing capabilities that we have, that the Oregon strategy makes sense. If we had ubiquitous, inexpensive, easily accessible testing, then there's a lot more things we would do. But to be clear, surveillance, where you use your test as a way to sort of identify, deal with your population. For example, everybody at SOU would be tested, three times a week. That's a different strategy than, gee, it's Tuesday, I think I'll go get tested for COVID. I think the one strategy helps us a lot, and the other doesn't help us much.
All right. So if testing were more readily available, you're saying that you would recommend more people get tests?
I would. I would recommend it in a coordinated fashion. Mm-hmm. I think there's pluses and minuses for people just getting tested willy-nilly without symptoms. It can give you a false sense of security, and we see that all the time. An example would be somebody who's quarantined because they were directly exposed to a positive case. Those people want to run out and get tested so they can go back to work or go back to, and not have to be in quarantine. And that random single isolated test doesn't get them out of quarantine. It doesn't tell us really that they're of no danger to the public anymore. So that would be an example of a test that actually was sort of had negative implications.
All right, so you've got to be careful on how you think about the testing once you've got it. And then so based on the availability within Oregon, within Jackson County in particular, where you are the medical director, what would you recommend about who should get tested?
I think anybody with any symptoms should get tested. And and then obviously get tested if you've been recommended to get tested because of exposure or other population-related issues. But from a public health perspective, it would be good to have access to rapid point-of-care inexpensive testing so that we could facilitate school reopening and, events like that that would lead us to more normal behavior.
All right, I got a drop-off phone call here from Don in Mount Shasta. I used to get prostate flare-ups 10 to 15 years ago and hadn't had any. I'm trying to figure out the wording here, but I recently had another instance where it returned with the conversation of how wildfire smoke could permeate organs in the body. He was curious if this could be the cause of his returning case. So if your prostate is flaring up and because you've been around smoke, is that a possible connection?
I just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting question, but I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, Dr. Jim Shames again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from Jackson County Health and Human Services. He is the county medical director. Phone calls welcome at 800-838-3760. Now back to testing for COVID though.
Yeah.
Oregon does not recommend that exposed people get tested after exposure to asymptomatic people. Which by reporting yesterday, indicates that that's actually somewhat lower standard than CDC.
Right. I know there was an awful lot of discussion about the CDC's recommendations that they put out and then retracted, et cetera. But to me, the important part is having a strategy. This is really important, and it affects the whole community. And to put it all on just an individual, I think I'll get tested, I think I won't get tested. I think it has much less impact than if there's a strategy for the group that individual belongs to, whether it be a workplace or a school. We're a bit different than the nation. It would be great if we had a national strategy, if we had leadership that provided us with really clear guidance. But in the absence of that, I think Oregon has to kind of look across the landscape at what materials we have, what our capabilities are, and create a strategy that makes sense for the whole state. So I'm okay with where we're at the moment.
I was going to ask about that guidance, clear or otherwise, from the CDC, and you appear to feel otherwise. The CDC talked about, don't bother to get tested if you're exposed to somebody who's asymptomatic for less than 15 minutes. If you know they're positive, that was withdrawn. CDC put something else out about aerosols being the major concern at
right.
the moment that perhaps
right.
they can track, and
right.
that was withdrawn.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, when you're trying to make heads or tails of this, as somebody involved in public health, I mean, where do you go if the CDC is not proving reliable?
Well, initially, my thought about the CDC was that they're so conservative that they just kind of move glacially, and that if we had really strong feelings, either regionally or on a statewide basis, that we needed to do what we thought was right. But in retrospect, there may have been more politics involved in the speed and the way in which CDC has provided guidance. I don't know the answer to that, but ultimately, we have to do what we think is right for our citizens. Personally, I've suspected that aerosol transmission has been a component almost from the beginning, and so that would explain why being indoors is so much more likely to spread the disease than being outdoors. I don't think there's any doubt there's some aerosolization here, and again, people should be really careful when they get indoors with strangers and really wonder, ask themselves whether they could do whatever it is about what they're about to do more expeditiously with more distance between people, or maybe do it outside.
Mm-hmm. And just to differentiate again, aerosols versus droplets. Droplets, do what wet droplets do. They fall, but aerosols don't, it sounds like. They suspend for a while?
Yeah, so the virus obviously is tiny, but if the virus is riding on a mucus droplet that is pretty large size, gravity will take over and that mucus droplet will fall to the ground, after it exits your mouth. Now, if you're singing, that droplet's going to go a lot further away from your mouth than if you're just breathing. But just the nature of droplets, some of them are very, very tiny and some are big. The tiny ones that have virus attached to them will go further away from you, and air currents and float in the air and maybe go further away than just 6 feet or 9 feet. And so the suspicion is that there is aerosolization of droplets when they leave your mouth. They can float in the air. We don't know the percentage. We don't know how likely that is to give you COVID, but I think people should be cautious to the extent that it's true, and be extra careful indoors.
Jim Shames, the American Public Health Association, commented over the weekend on reaching the milestone of 200,000 U.S. deaths from COVID-19. I wonder what that makes you think of.
Well, it's really sad to see something that is so potentially preventable to get to that degree. I mean, something as simple as wearing a facial covering, if we as an entire nation said, oh yeah, we can do that, we're going to do that for our neighbors, we're going to do it for everyone, and we, everywhere we looked, you know, the leadership from the top on down were doing it appropriately and advocating it, we really would unlikely be in the position we're in now.
There's something psychological tied up in this, isn't there? I mean, if everybody were told to wear long sleeves, I don't think we'd have a problem with that, but putting something in front of your face is kind of a different thing for humans.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I do know that some cultures have accepted it readily, and, you know, a lot of Asia uses face masks routinely, and I think it's become accepted, and people do it, and I suspect they reduce an awful lot of infectious disease transmission as a result of it.
Yeah, I've seen all the pictures of people in Asian countries wearing face masks just in flu season. We do have flu season approaching and cold weather approaching.
Yeah.
You've already mentioned the concerns about the fire victims potentially living in more crowded living conditions, but talk about COVID plus flu season approaching now.
Well, COVID's in the background, and it's likely to pick up as school reopens and people go indoors. And then the same phenomena happens with influenza and other respiratory infections. And I think people who are co-infected with both are likely to get much sicker. It just stands to reason. And there's no logical reason why you wouldn't get or couldn't get infected with both. So get your flu shot, do it early, and follow all the usual precautions that ought to reduce the likelihood of getting influenza just as much as reducing the likelihood of getting COVID.
So flu shots as soon as available, not just wait till October or something?
No, I do it now. Mm-hmm. And wash your hands, wear a mask, keep your social distance, and you're less likely to get the flu.
All right, all the above. Jim Shames, Dr. Jim Shames from Jackson County Health and Human Services, the medical director. Thanks for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Take it easy.